Welcome. This is Christopher Holmes. It is October 16th, 2010, and this is another two-hour zero-point radio show through BBS Radio. I'm coming to you from just south of Ottawa, Ontario, Canada, and we're into our fifth year of programs through BBS. I'd like to welcome my co-host, James Moffat. Hi, Jim. How are you?
I'm good. How are you, Chris?
Good. Okay, Jim is from Toronto, Ontario, and we've been long-time seekers after truth in our studies of the esoteric literature and modern science and philosophy and so on. I work under the logo of Zero Point, and that is a term taken from Madame Blavatsky's Secret Doctrine, published in 1888. And this is a classic work of Western occultism. And it is said to be based on the stanzas of Zan, spelled D-Z-Y-A-N. And these stanzas were said to be written in a language of Zenzar, spelled S-E-N-Z-A-R, which Blavatsky said was unknown to modern philologists, like people who study language and such. Blavatsky claims in her work on the secret doctrine that these stanzas were actually dictated to the first beings, the first root race of our fifth cycle of life on planet Earth. And so she says it's this ancient teaching that goes back even to Atlantean times. And she says it was dictated to initiates in the Himalayan region of Tibet in early prehistory. And these stanzas of Zen, there are seven stanzas, and they range from about 8 to 15 verses each. And what they depict is creation processes, creation of the universe. Okay, it's like in the first verses of the book of Genesis, which describes the creation of the universe. Well, these ancient stanzas are depicting the same thing, the creation of the universe. And they begin when creation is unmanifested and everything is said to exist in a state of non-being, which is like the absolute being. So in the beginning, it's referred to as the nights of Brahma, when everything is absorbed into the nothingness. Okay, so it's pre-creation. And then the stanzas depict the nature of that nothingness, because they say that nothingness, partly it's what's called the eternal parent space. Okay, so it's like a hyperspace dimension, or the mother space, or a root space. Okay, and out of this eternal parent space emerge sons, like S-O-N-S, or living beings emerge out of this hyperspace. So four-dimensional space-time worlds emerge out of this hyperspace. And the concept in the secret doctrine is that they begin from an initial first point, a zero point, or what in modern science would be called a singularity condition. That there is a first point of differentiation of a living cosmos out of the nothingness. Okay, that's this one of the concepts of these archaic stanzas of Zen. Blavatsky would call that a zero point. And I would maintain that all living beings have a similarly such a zero point center. And this is actually exists in relationship to the higher dimensional physics of the human heart. That in a way, the human heart is not simply a material organ, even though it is that as well, but it is ensouled through the pacemaker of the heart, which generates a heartbeat and brings life into the body. And the body, a human being, is ensouled through the activities of the heart and then the breath and the circulation of the breath through the blood. And that is how a human being is ensouled. So a human being's soul is in the mystical literature, most intimately connected to the heart and soul. So the idea is that a human being has a first point. In a way, you might think of that in yourself as being the singular I, the letter I. Okay, is there an I in the human being? Like scientists today, they think, they would say, oh, the brain is simply a pack of neurons. Okay, or we are nothing but an assembly of cells or molecules. And they have a materialistic conception of life. But in this archaic teachings, really we have a higher life center and a first point, zero point center. And life emerges within, without, from a zero point. And when a being dies, the life withdraws from without, within, back to the zero point center. So you might imagine the universe created from a singularity getting bigger and bigger and bigger and eventually contracting back again, collapsing at the end of time into a singularity and back into the nothingness, which in science would be called the quantum vacuum. So you might imagine creation from zero point centers emerging within, without, and then without, within, back to a zero-point center and back into the nothingness. Okay, that is the basic concept conveyed within the secret doctrine of the root, the origins of living beings. Okay, so the idea, I work under that logo of zero-point. See, the term zero-point has all kinds of meanings also in modern physics. And I don't want to get off into that, but in a way, there's a whole physics of what I'm trying to explain about the zero-point center within the human heart. I'm saying there's a higher dimensional physics to us as beings, and we have to awaken and realize this. Okay. Today, actually, I've talked off of topic a little bit. Jim, how are you? Today, we had a few things that we kind of wanted to do in our show today. We want to talk about the new copy produced of my book on psychological illusions on the Gurdjieff teaching. And then we were going to maybe discuss the review of the Heart Doctrine book that Donna Brown had published in the Journal of Esoteric Studies. So, and then we have some new ideas. We've been talking a little bit about shifting our focus for a while to the Gurdjieff teaching. And recently, Jim and I have been talking of doing a series based on Beelzebub's tales to his grandson. That was quite exciting, eh, Jim, to consider doing that.
Yeah, it's, you know, I was thinking about it because it's Beelzebub's Tales to His Grandson, which is Gurdjieff's magnum opus. He wrote three books, but it's the most important of the three works, and even though the others are important in their own ways. But it's difficult to understand it. It's an allegory, and there are so many allusions in it, and it's so impenetrable in a way. But it's an amazing book, and unfortunately, really hasn't been given the attention that I think that it deserves. And in a part, I think part of the problem is that you really have to, on some level, I think you have to understand other aspects of Gurdjieff's teaching. You have to, you can read the book without knowing anything about him or his teaching, but it contains so much more when you have some idea about what he's talking about, because he doesn't tell you anything very directly in the book. It's all a set of allusions and very subtly presented on a variety of levels with different shades of meanings. It's a very difficult book to understand, and I wouldn't pretend to say that I understand it at all. I think your book, The Slugs, which is a commentary on it, is very, very good. But again, because you have such a knowledge of the teaching already, it's quite amazing in a way that for such an important book, I think one of the real spiritual classics, there's precious little really written about it. It's very odd in a way that it hasn't drawn more attention. But in another sense, I understand why there's a lack of commentary on it. So yeah, with that caveat in mind, I think it's it's an adventure. It's an exploration of what is this guy talking about, because he very purposely, in his words, he buries the dog deeper. And somebody said to him, "You mean you bury the bone deeper?" He said, "No, I buried the dog deeper." And that's an example kind of the way he speaks, because in a sense he's saying that the reader is buried under the weight of all of their associations and all of their common knowledge, and in his terms, all of their misunderstanding of things, and so that you have to kind of surface almost to begin to get it. And in another sense, the dog reference is to Sirius, the dog star, which is a symbol of wisdom. So the wisdom is buried very deeply, and that's just like one example.
Oh yeah, wow.
Of how everything Gurdjieff says in that book, basically, one point somebody asked him about the book, and he said about the history of it, because it's a history of the planet Earth and of humankind, and it's a radically different history from conventional history. And he said to somebody at one point, everything in Beelzebub is historical.
Yeah.
Now, you know, that's hard to believe, but in another sense, you know, there's a way in which I think it is believable that everything is historical. So, yeah.
I think it would be fascinating for us to do a series of shows on the tales, and we can give some of the history and the story, and then we can read selections from Beelzebub, because parts of it are just so hilariously funny. He depicts human beings so succinctly, and makes one realize how ridiculous we would look to kind of like someone from a higher dimension or someone who had objective reason. Like Beelzebub in this book, he's attained objective reason, and he's kind of looking at the mankind on planet Earth. And I realized this time in reading the book that one of the main themes of the book is, what are the causes of war?
Yeah.
That's one of the main, that's why Beelzebub visits the planet Earth from Mars on different occasions on his spaceship called Occasion. And he visits the planet at different times, and he talks a lot about, like, what are the causes of war? And I've been working at preparing The Slugs to have it published, and in the newest edition of The Slugs, I particularly emphasized reading that long last chapter in the Tales again on Beelzebub's opinions of war. And it is just unbelievable, some of the things in that chapter that I hadn't grasped before. Like, every time you read it, you grasp new things, and you kind of learn the language so you can read the book. It's a fascinating, ultra-magical type of book. So I thought what we should do over the next three or four shows, once we have copies of The Slugs, is that we'll go through some of the tales and read sections of it. But we're going to especially focus on the idea, what are the causes of war? Because in a way, I think Beelzebub's tales, is one of the most profound anti-war documents ever produced. And I don't think that's ever been real. I didn't realize that myself to the extent to which when I reread it this time, that how much that shocked me. So that would be good to do over the next shows.
Doesn't he say at some point in that book that humans are the only beings in that he's familiar with that have this peculiar property in their psyche, which leads them to the reciprocal destructions of being similar to themselves, or what they call war? Doesn't he say something like that to that effect? That this is a peculiar, like, war is a peculiarly human.
He kind of says it's unknown elsewhere in the cosmos.
Yeah.
It's so rare that's kind of why he's asked to investigate what is the causes of it.
And then he relates it to the degeneration of the traditional religious past and the malefic properties of their psyche, which have resulted from the organ Kundu buffer being implanted. I mean, there's a whole mythological explanation of why we are the way we are. But, like, I want to come back to this one thing that you said at the beginning. Is Beelzebub is this being who has realized objective reason, and it's very fascinating that he represents an alien intelligence. And so it's through his voice and his observations and his history of humanity that the book unfolds. And what he does is that, Gurdjieff does in the book, is that he creates this distance between Beelzebub and human beings, and he engenders that in the reader. So you start thinking, like, wow, these people are really strange, you know. He also breaks down through his very peculiar lexicon and his very peculiar and very difficult rhythm that he establishes in his prose and his way of stating things, but he breaks down all your normal associations to language. I mean, in terms of experimental literature, I think this is light years beyond anything I've ever read in terms of experimental literature, because of the substance of it. But it is experimental in that sense, and it's mythological in the sense that while it's directed, I mean, you have to reason and think about it, it's directed also to your heart and to your higher emotional center in fourth way terms, and it appeals to your intellect and to your emotions at the same time in a very peculiar way. But it's this idea that he creates this distance. It's sort of almost like at times it's like he's an entomologist who's studying bugs, you know, like these slugs under the microscope. It's very peculiar how he's able to achieve that. And as you say, parts of it are just hilarious, and when he's sort of deflating the wiseacring of human beings, as he refers to it, and kind of all the vainglorious manifestations that human beings celebrate in their history. He keeps. I know he refers to Alexander the Great as that vainglorious Greek, and has various phrases like that are very, very funny in terms of his portrayal of things. And as I say, the cumulative effect of the telling of the tale is that you start to feel like, you start to look more objectively at human beings, and you just question sort of all the assumptions that people make when they repeat human history. And as you say, at the heart of it really is this idea, is like, these guys are always killing themselves in what they term wars. What is this that leads them to this? It's a very, very interesting book on that level.
Yeah, and it's very complex. Like, when I came to revising the slugs, I was trying to understand, well, what does he say about the causes of war, you know? And I had to kind of really go back and, like, read and reread it to try to grasp that more closely. I mean, one of the central things is, like, about what you were saying about the degeneracy of the human psyche on planet Earth.
Yeah.
That's partly they perceive everything upside down, like they're not in touch with reality, and they have this kind of false consciousness system. And the effects of education are to kind of stuff them full of all this ephemeral knowledge, like not real understanding. It's just all the rubbish accumulated through the centuries in human mentation. So it's like, so human being, it's a degeneracy of the human psyche is one aspect of it. And then in that chapter, he starts going into, like Hasin asks him, but why don't human beings, why don't they see how horrible these processes of war are and collect together and try to deal with it? And he actually talks about the League of Nations, which in that day, in the 1920s, in Gurdjieff's time, was comparable to our UN today, I think most comparable. And it was supposed to be a society to kind of eliminate war and such. And then he goes into this long history, taking Hasin back through different times in early history, even to Babylon, where they had different assemblies trying to meet and eradicate warfare. So he tells stories about these different assemblies and what happened at them through history. That's part of that chapter as well. He launches into all these discussions of the nature of the power-possessing beings and what their nature is. Like, they're the most vainglorious, and they're the ones who, like, he describes what he calls the intelligentsia, which he explains aren't really intelligentsia at all, but he calls them, they should really be called mechanogentsia, because they're completely mechanized. Because he says that maleficent education is especially applied to those young beings who are to grow up and as a rule assume the position of power-possessing beings. And so they get the heaviest kind of dose of this maleficent education of theirs. Okay, thank you. So he launches into this whole thing about the nature of the power-possessing beings. And then there's what he calls the hasnamus individuals, which all his discussion of the hasnamuses and their role through human history and in creating wars and all of that is absolutely fascinating. And why these societies that are supposed to create, to eradicate war, never accomplish anything. And what it is about the psychology of these power-possessing beings that nothing is ever attained. It's an absolutely fascinating study. And in terms of the war and such, he comes to discussions of the moon and how human beings can live and die as one and two-brained beings instead of dying as three-brained beings. It's a fascinating discussion of the causes of war. So we will take up exploring Beelzebub's tales over the next 3 to 4 shows and go into this in more detail. And I've just heard that from Seth there at BBS that we have online this young lady is from Croatia. And she, about 6 months ago, chanced to email me to order some of my books, and which I mailed off to her. And then she offered at one point to, she started doing illustrations for my work, because at the time I was just trying to publish God, Science, and the Secret Doctrine, and I was faced with the problem of having a series of illustrations from Scientific American, which I didn't have copyrights for, so I had problems with illustrations, and this lady stepped forward and kind of completed those for me and enabled me to publish God, Science, and the Secret Doctrine. And then she subsequently did all the pre-press and layouts for Psychological Illusions and really laid this book out in the most creative and artful manner. And I've just kind of known Zelchka just through the internet. So this is Zelchka Zupanic from Croatia. Hi, Zelchka, welcome.
Hello. Hello, Christopher.
Can you understand me okay with my...
Yeah. It is Jelka. Jelka Zupanic.
Okay.
It's fine.
It must be late there in Croatia. Are you about midnight or something?
No, it's 10:24.
Oh, yeah. So about 6 hours difference between us.
Yeah. It is, yeah.
Well,
yeah,
I have...
to hear you.
You did such an amazing job on laying out psychological illusions, Zelchka, like the manner in which you used the black pages as dividers between the sections and the illustrations, how each section opens up with a large illustration. So much of what you did made it such an attractive book, and I just wanted to thank you so much for doing that.
Yeah, it's fine. That's my job. That's how it should be done. So
is that what you do in your life for a living? Like, do you lay out books, Zelchka?
Yeah, I do graphic design. So it's like logotypes, visual identity, and books and everything. So.
Wow! Well, you're really very talented, and it was so. I mean, this hasn't been your job. You know, I hadn't been paying you.
But it's my job to do these black pages and all that. So you always look at the subject and you can find out how can you manage to get closer to the people, you know, so it's important sometimes to make something, you know, like those quotes, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I don't have words in English, so I hope you understand what I want to say.
Well, I think Zelchka's referring each section of the book, just I'll explain here to the audience, Zelchka, each section of the book has like two black pages, and she has the quote for the next section in large print on these pages, and it's very effective. Like, one of the earliest, I'll just find my book here. I'm going to read the first section of the book has completely black pages, and it says, "So, first thing must learn is no self. If not do this, then we'll be like acorn that not become tree." And mm-hmm. and she has a Gurdjieff signature there, and it's just so attractive. It's funny. You certainly laid it out very nicely, and it's a long and difficult book, and you made it your presentation made it accessible, like they chunked it properly. Jim, you had comments on the book too, and you're familiar with my work. Maybe you could share with Zelchka some of your impressions.
Yeah, hi. I really like your work. I think you did a wonderful job. This is a beautiful book, and I've been looking at this manuscript in some fashion for 35 years, and one of the things that I said, and it looks beautiful, one of the things I said to Chris is that it's a very dense book in the sense that there's a lot of content to it, and I like that you put it into this bigger format, and I like the way it's spread out because it makes it feel much more accessible, and it doesn't feel so overwhelming. I think that the way it was sort of laid out before was a little bit, there's nothing wrong in terms of the content of it at all, but it just feels right when I was looking through it, and it looks fantastic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's what design is for, you know. Some subject you can make really with this presentation, how you lay it out, to easier to read for people, and some things they can really understand better if you make it big letters or something. You can, I don't know, you can make accent on things which you think that they need to be, like you know, I don't know the word.
Yeah, I think that's
you know
exactly.
What I mean.
Exactly what you've done with the book. I think that
exactly.
You're right, and I think that's you've just done a wonderful job because it that's what you've achieved. It's just presented so beautifully and it just reads in an easier fashion in a sense too. Same book, but you know it looks great.
Yeah,
but I need to say that Christopher really prepared the text really, really well. So when someone does it like this, it's not difficult to make design, you know?
Yeah. Yes.
So when you have really such a, you know, this text, it because there was like flow in it, you know. You always had these quotations and everything, so you can really pick up and make it like whole, you know, good design. Do you understand what I meant?
Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
Thank you.
I should say this because when I work with people with design, it's really rare that people prepare texts like this. So we have a lot of problems when we do design, like people don't have this, you know, such a great text. It's really easy. That's why I did it so fast.
I'm sorry, are you getting some interference on your phone?
Hello?
Hello, Delchka, are you having interference on your phone, or Jim, are you?
Yeah, there's lots. I could barely hear the last.
Oh, yeah, I was losing part of what Zelchka. Okay. I didn't know if it was my phone or if you were hearing that as well.
I think it's between us and her, because I can hear you perfectly, but I can't hear her very well.
Yeah, I was losing her at one point there.
Yeah.
Zelchka, I'm wondering, have you studied, you were only beginning to learn something of Gurdjieff and Uspensky when you took up this project? Had you studied them at all, or do you have any impressions of the material? Okay, so, I just heard from Seth there, who's looking after us here, that there was a lot of the static, so he's going to try to reconnect. Well, that was really interesting what she was saying, Jim?
Yeah.
Because what she formulated is exactly how the book struck me. Like,
as I say, it's such a fun, odd thing to see it. You were telling me about it, and you were so excited a couple of weeks ago, and then you sent it to me, and the first thing was that I was surprised by the size of the book, because it's bigger than the normal trade paperback. But I realized, too, that, I mean, when you had it in Sherlock's binding, it's sort of that's a big format, but somehow she just put it, it's just so, it looks so good, you know, and this is a very interesting book. I mean, because this is the first book, really, that, as I said, it's 35 years ago that you really started writing this book when you started your dissertation. And subsequently, it's really about 31, 32 years old. And originally, it was man's psychological illusions, and it mainly dealt with the, what I would call the Uspenskian version of the fourth way, which I think you relied heavily on In Search of the Miraculous and The Fourth Way and some of the canon of the Gurdjieff books, and not so much on Beelzebub's Tales. And it was a very good explanation, an exposition of the Gurdjieff teaching, very thorough, very well-informed, and you relate it to modern psychology and philosophy and the ideas about the nature of consciousness in modern psychology and philosophy. But then later, when you began to revise it and it became psychological illusions, and in the 80s, you started to add material from Beelzebub's Tales. And so I think it's like we've talked about this. In the last 40 years, Gurdjieff books keep appearing, but there really haven't, in my opinion, I don't think there have been that many really good ones. And I don't know of any other book which is really quite as comprehensive about the fourth way ideas as this book is, and in all of the books that have been published in recent years. So anyone interested in fourth way or Gurdjieff and Uspensky, I think you would definitely enjoy this book and find it very informative, very stimulating. And now we've said, it's in this very attractive format and laid out very nicely. It's a very comprehensive treatment of the teaching.
Yeah, I must say I'm most pleased with it, and it's amazing because, as you mentioned, like, this came out of my thesis work, and
right.
When I was a graduate student in psychology, I became interested in the nature of human consciousness, because all the psychotherapists talked about, like, bringing the unconscious into consciousness, or things that were outside of awareness, how you needed to bring them into awareness. So I realized that at the heart of psychotherapy must be somehow the development or attaining or increase of human consciousness. So I became interested in what is human consciousness, and you know, 30, 40 years later, I'm still on the same search, but now I feel I have a lot of understanding, a whole understanding that I didn't have at that time. Okay, so the book actually goes back, and I was using that book when I was a professor at York University, and I incorporated it into my teaching because it so complements Western psychology. And the Gurdjieff teaching is the most practical teaching of all teachings that I know from a psychological perspective, in terms of explaining what are the parts of a human being and what are the levels of consciousness and what are your different bodies, like your different being bodies. Gurdjieff explains that we don't just have a planetary body, but a Kesjan body, and what we would call a mental body. So we have these different being bodies. He calls it the highest being body. And that's what we're wanting to attain in Beelzebub's Tales. It's a story about how people don't fulfill their being obligations, and so they don't develop their higher being bodies. So this whole teaching is in Beelzebub's Tales about how to develop your higher being bodies. That's a hidden element all through the tales. I understand we have Zelchka back. Hi, Zelchka. I'm sorry we lost you. We were started to get a lot of interference.
Hello, can you hear me now?
Perfectly, clearly.
Okay. There's something with the internet. I don't know.
Yeah.
Connection was bad.
I was interested, Zelchka, like, I mean, it was very kind of you to do this work to help me and then to set this book up. And have you studied, like, esoteric teachings or the Gurdjieff teaching or Blavatsky? Have you studied these things in your life?
No.
No, you haven't.
No, but,
oh, yeah.
But I came across Gurdjieff book. It's called Only When I Am, I'm Alive, something like this. I don't know in English.
Yeah, life is only real then when I am.
Yeah,
it's a complex title. Yeah.
So that's only book I read, and there is something which really attracts me with Gurdjieff, what he says, and now when I'm doing this book for you, I read something, you know, when I work, but I didn't read it. I can't wait actually to get those books to start reading. So,
yeah, that's about, yeah, you must, yeah. It must be, when you're focusing on laying it out, that'll be really nice. It reads so beautifully when it's in that presentation. It's just so easy to read. For me, it's like it's someone else's book. I don't feel a connection with it almost.
Yeah, so I will read it for sure because I'm really interested. And I heard for Beelzebub, is Beelzebub Tales?
Yes.
That is really big, big book. I don't know. So and I... I don't know, I don't like when books are so big, so this one's going to be better for me, you know, your one, to read it.
It's a good, it would be a good introduction to Beelzebub's Tales.
That's what I mean. Yeah,
it would help a person approach it, because Beelzebub's Tales, like, it is big and it's very, very difficult. Yeah,
and that's what I heard, so I think this would be really good introduction for me.
That's why Gurdjieff, when he had his flat in Paris after the war, they would have readings in his apartment where they'd have readings from Beelzebub's Tales. And they did that for years, I understand, public readings, and he worked at revising it over and over again. So we're going to have some, do a series of shows on Beelzebub's Tales over the next 3 to 4 shows, Zelchka.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I will listen. I will try to listen. So, to hear what you say about it.
Yeah. Yeah, great. Wow. So, and I've mentioned to people that we're not too far away from even completing the slugs.
I'm doing on it. I think it will be next week.
Yeah,
we will have it done. So it really goes well. I'm almost at the end.
Oh yeah, oh that's so excellent.
Yeah.
I'm just so pleased. So appreciate the work you've done.
Yeah, and I like it. It's going to be the same format as Psychological Illusions, so it's going to be together.
Yeah, they'll really go nicely together. Jim,
yeah.
They're going to be the same dividing sections between the chapters, like, and the whole design will be the same. And
that'll look great. Very nice, yeah.
It's a shorter book. The other one's almost 300 pages. This is more like 160, 170. It's quite a bit shorter. Yeah. Anyway, well, thanks, Zelchka, and thank you for joining us today. We'll have you back on in the future.
Yeah,
well, pleasure. You should be getting your books this week, and it'll give you time to get to read some of it.
Yeah. Thank you very much.
Zelchka, what is your native language? What's your first language?
Croatian.
Okay, I wasn't exactly sure. I Well, you do very well with your English.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Very good.
I miss some words. I'm missing some words, so it would be easier for me if I know them to express myself. I think this was fine.
Yeah, you did really well. Yeah. Thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you, Christopher.
Okay.
Thanks for coming on.
Bye-bye.
Goodbye. Wow, what a pleasure, eh?
Yeah, it's very exciting. I don't think anybody can really appreciate this as much as you and I, because, like I say, we've been fooling around with this thing. I mean, I don't know how many times, edits and rewrites, and I mean it's probably 15 to 20 over the years different editions of that book, and reworking it, but just to see it this way is really exciting. I couldn't figure out why you were so excited until I saw it, and then I thought, okay, now I understand why you're so excited, because it really does look wonderful, and she just did a tremendous job. It's so interesting too that she hasn't read the book, but she just sort of grasped it on some level. That's very interesting that she was able to do that.
Yeah, she seemed very intuitive somehow. Early on, she felt that she just felt that she was meant to help me somehow. You know, like, why would she put so many hours into this? And I mean, I haven't been paying her for her. She's been doing it on her own behest. Yeah, I'm just so appreciative, and you know, and like I say, not only producing Psychological Illusions like that, but enabling me to get produced God, Science, and the Secret Doctrine, which is ended up as a beautiful production. And you see, even in the newest edition of the Heart Doctrine, there's a couple of her graphics in there which replaced the worst of the prior illustrations. So I'm really so thankful and excited about producing the slugs, especially this new version of the slugs with all this stuff on wars, and I tie it all into what's happening in the world now. It provides a shocking view of
it's
the
kind
strange...
of funny that when you were talking about that, it reminded me the first book I wrote was something of a spiritual autobiography, and it was really about the first 5 years that you and I studied the Fourth Way and got interested in esotericism as graduate students in psychology, and a very magical, very interesting period, and that was from 1976 to 1981, which is when I moved to Toronto and came to work with you when you were living here, and I was living in Ottawa, and now it's backwards, but it was interesting because that was a period of like when there was real concern about nuclear war, it really seemed that things were sort of spiraling out of control. The Russians were in Afghanistan, and there was the Iranian students takeover, and Reagan came to power, and it was very difficult period in a way, in my book, I have a chapter, a long chapter called The Crossroads, what I did was I was discussing the current political situation to a limited extent, and then I tried to take what Gurdjieff said about war from his speeches in Search of the Miraculous, one of the ones that very famous, very interesting, because Gurdjieff, when he came to Russia, he came just before the Russian Revolution and just before the First World War. And at one of the meetings, Uspensky reports that Gurdjieff said that there is no progress whatsoever, that the idea of progress was an illusion. And Uspensky says this made a very strong impact on us, because at the time, that really things were going down the tubes in terms of the First World War had started and the revolution was coming, and Uspensky tells his story to the group that one day he had been walking along and he had seen these two trucks, several trucks go by, which had open tops and they were loaded with crutches. And he said, these lorry loads of crutches went by, and he was struck by the meaning of it all, like that in these lorry loads of crutches was the stark reminder about all the hypocrisy of the fine words and lies in which people, like politicians, represented the situation. And the reality was that these crutches, which were being prepared for, this is just before the war started, I guess, were being prepared for limbs which were not yet torn off, but which were going to be. In cities, all these different cities in Europe, cities like that he had visited and he loved because they were all so different. Now everybody was at their one another's throats, and it was just a matter of time before all of this was going to come crashing down, and all of these people were going to be killed and maimed and wounded. And Gurdjieff said, "Well, what do you expect? People are machines, and if one person's mechanical, then 1,000 people are mechanical, and 1,000 people are mechanical, 100,000 people and 1,000,000 people are mechanical, and they all just follow the dictates of whatever this mass hypnosis in which they're caught up and which leads to war." And he explains in there, he talks at another point about the evolution of life on planet Earth, and he talks about that life can come at different points to cross what he calls the crossroads, and either it can develop or it can deviate. And this is all told in terms of his idea of octave development. And he says, like, either things can progress or they can go off somewhere completely unintended, and the potential for progression ends. And he said, this is sort of like the whole history of humanity is like this. And you know, it's impossible to tell where we are at any one point as to whether, you know, whether or not we're at the crossroads or the crossroads are coming or we've passed the crossroads. But it struck me at the time that we were at the crossroads in the late 70s and early 80s. You know, it seemed like that we had reached this point. Now, whether or not that's true, you know, you could say, well, you know, the crossroads was really the beginning of the First World War, or was the advent of the Industrial Revolution. Who knows? I mean, we don't know. That's the point. And, I mean, it's very... Again, we're in the with September, you know, September 11th. It seems like, you know, that was a crossroads in terms of world history. I mean, you can relate to all sorts of things, but what struck me is that in search of the miraculous, there's plenty of like really astonishing material about war in there too. And the other thing that I related to in this book was that. I had read this incredible essay by Henry Miller called Murder the Murderer, which was written at the beginning of the Second World War and completed the second part at the end of the Second World War. And it was an open letter to a friend of his who was a private in the French army. And really, Miller dissects his commentary on the causes of war. He kind of disdains the socio-political explanations that people offer, and his method is much more psychological. And he says a lot of things that are very controversial, but in terms of established understanding of things, but are so prescient in terms of what he predicts. Now, this is like in 1940, he started the essay, and he finished it in 1945. And it's amazing how right on he was in terms of what he predicted which would happen. And yet, everything he says is kind of contrary to the, you know, the popular wisdom about politics and sociology and history. Because his method is psychological, he's dealing with more the psychological causes of war, and that's what he bases his predictions on. And it's a great anti-war essay, and so I combined that with Gurdjieff's commentary, and I think that's where you begin to realize that, well, you know, there is another explanation to all this. I mean, what I guess I realized more than anything else is that nobody really understands the causes of war, or people would stop fighting them, you know, maybe. But, you know, it really is one of the great mysteries. It's something that we've come to accept that it's just the way people are. But why do people do this?
Well, that and it'll be interesting over the next series of shows. You can bring in some of what Miller says too. We'll bring that into our discussion because, I'm astounded at some of the things I find on going back, especially the role Gurdjieff ascribes to the Hasnamas individuals throughout human history and what their roles have been, and that. Hasnamas for Gurdjieff, it's like they're like psychopaths, but they're not just psychopaths. But the defining characteristic for Gurdjieff or Beelzebub of what a Hasnamas is that they don't experience objective conscience. That they don't experience objective conscience because Beelzebub regards conscience as a sacred being impulse. And he says that it's passed in people, it's passed into their subconscious because they've kind of formed a false consciousness system and their real consciousness has passed into their what they call their subconscious. And so it's very important for Gurdjieff is this the presence of conscience in someone. And that's why for Gurdjieff, in history, he explains all the activities of these Hasnamas individuals through history. In terms of their what he calls their Hasnamasian spectrum of impulses, and here's his list of the spectrum of impulses characteristic of Hasnamases. I shouldn't go through this. Well, we'll do this in the future, but I'll go through it quickly now.
It's worth it.
The first is, for people who are wondering, like, this is, in a way, what I would characterize the New World Order elites in the world today are all what Beelzebub calls the crats, the democrats, the aristocrats, all the different plutocrats and so on. Anyway, every kind of depravity, conscious as well as unconscious. Number two, the feeling of self-satisfaction from leading others astray. I think of the modern, the corporate media, eh? All the husnamuses in the corporate media leading people astray about everything. The number three, the irresistible inclination to destroy the existence of other breathing creatures. Wow. Number four, the urge to become free from the necessity of actualizing the being efforts demanded by nature. Number four, the attempt by every kind of artificiality to conceal from others what, in their opinion, are one's physical defects. Number six, the calm self-contentment in the use of what is not personally deserved. And number seven, the striving to be not what one is. It's quite a list of characteristics, hey, Jeff?
Yeah.
But it's interesting in his tales, you see. That's what I saw more when I reread the tales this time. I saw more what he was saying about this type of individual through history, what they've done, not like to propagate wars, like he refers to the stock jugglers, you know, one of his phrases, and the power-possessing beings, you know, and how they make profits off the wars, and there's a lot of real insights into, I think, the world situation at this time, and
it's interesting, about Gurdjieff, that again, going back to this sort of goes to psychological illusions, but back when we were in graduate school and you were doing your doctorate, and you mentioned this earlier, you know, you were going to be a clinical psychologist and you were doing psychotherapy and learning about psychotherapy and that's what you wanted to do, and I had been out of school and came back and I was doing my master's in psychology and I was going to become a clinical psychologist too. I was going to get my PhD. I wanted to do therapy, and I remember when you know we were first introduced to Gurdjieff, you know, there was the teaching itself, and then there was just like this guy, Gurdjieff, like, who was this guy? Because he was an extraordinary human being by any standards. He was an amazing person. But reading about him, I remember, like, you know, we were acquiring all these books and reading all these books about him, and he had this incredible life, which was shrouded in mystery, and nobody really knows what he did for the first 40 years of his life. He was born in Armenia in the Caucasus, and what's Armenia now in the Caucasus, and he traveled widely looking for ancient wisdom, and he went to archaeological sites throughout the Mideast and the Far East, and supposedly banded together with another group of people who were seekers after truth, who compared knowledge and were looking for things, and visited various religious communities and became an expert in Eastern dances and sacred gymnastics and movements. And clearly, by the time he came to Russia in 1912, he appeared in Moscow. He claimed that he had made contact with this ancient system which had been lost, the fourth way, and which had come and gone throughout history and reappeared at different times and always came for a purpose. Even though there are various elements in Gurdjieff's teaching in the fourth way that are clearly consistent with other elements in other esoteric teachings, he very emphatically says that this teaching is complete unto itself and has appeared and reappeared throughout history. And so...
Jim?
Yeah.
I just as you were saying that, that's the quote that opens this book. Do you mind, can I read this?
Yeah, please, yes.
This is from... He says, the teaching whose theory is here being set out is completely self-supporting and independent of other lines and it has been completely unknown up to the present time. And at one point, he kind of traces it back. He says to ancient Egypt, but he says it's an Egypt that we don't know of, like that the history's been lost.
Pre-Sand Egypt, I think he calls it. Like
he claims
that Egypt was a much more ancient civilization that is commonly recognized in modern archaeology and history, that it had existed much longer than is commonly recognized, that there was a highly advanced civilization, like the pre-Atlantean times, I believe is how he describes it. And that's something in Beelzebub's tales, just as an aside, is that when I said earlier that at one point he said everything in it is historical, well, you have to realize how incredible the history is that he presents of humanity and of Earth, which is so at odds kind of with conventional history and interpretations. It's an even more radical statement. But discovering this about this guy, and then who he was through Uspensky, especially reading In Search of the Miraculous, which is about his first several years interacting with Gurdjieff and attending these meetings and really brilliantly reproducing the content of it. In Search of the Miraculous is an amazing account of Gurdjieff, an amazing account of the Fourth Way, but it's an amazing feat of journalism because they weren't allowed to take notes, and Uspensky wrote this book a few years, I think, after the events happened, and then didn't really publish it until after it was published posthumously in 1948. I think he died in 47, something like that. It was before Gurdjieff died in 1949. But you get this portrait of Uspensky provides this incredible portrait of Gurdjieff as this guy. This man who had clearly made contact in Uspensky's terms with an esoteric school. Like Uspensky had been very active in the Leningrad, or it wasn't Leningrad, at that St. Petersburg Theosophical Society. He traveled widely in India and the Mideast and met all sorts of people who were quite developed in terms of spiritual development and obviously knew things, but he came back to Russia and was disappointed that he had never really met somebody who he felt really could impart to him what the knowledge of an esoteric school. And then seemingly serendipitously he met Gurdjieff, but Gurdjieff had actually targeted him, had been reading his pieces that Uspensky had filed on his travels, and then made contact with Uspensky. So in this book, you get this portrait of this very, very incredible figure, who is such an enigma, because as right from the beginning, Uspensky describes him as a man who you realize is poorly disguised, and you have to pretend that you don't realize that he's disguised, but it's just so obvious. And this refers to this very odd aspect of Gurdjieff, which is that he was very deliberately acting all the time. And he says at one point himself that he had taken a vow for a period of 21 years to lead an unnatural life. So everything about Gurdjieff is shrouded in these layers of complexity and difficulty to interpret exactly what he was doing and what his meaning was. But in Uspensky's book, you have the reproduction of these speeches, which are incredible, and which we've talked about this before on the program, but I think struck both of us. When I first read In Search of the Miraculous, I just knew that this was true. There was an air of authenticity and authority to what Gurdjieff was saying, which was unlike anything I'd ever read before. And I just recently read Jacob Needleman's book, who is a esoteric scholar and philosopher, and he says the same thing, that when he first read Uspensky, he knew that Gurdjieff knew what he was talking about, that this wasn't wiseacring, this is somebody who actually knew this. And so we were introduced to this.
That's amazing. That was our experience too. Like I felt, this is something substantially different than anything I'd been exposed to. Like there was just like an authenticity to it. Like I would say now it's objectively true. Like it's, you know, the other kind of theories and models are also incomplete and confused and such, but this is like a more complete knowledge, a system of knowledge, especially from a psychological point of view.
Yeah, and intellectually it's striking in its elegance and its sophistication and its lucidness and its coherence and its comprehensiveness. But at the same time, too, like in Gurdjieff, you get the idea that this guy understood that he lived this. This wasn't just something that he knew in his head. And I think that's what really struck me was that, wow, I wouldn't even pretend to begin to understand who this guy was, but what... Obviously, it was obvious that he had made contact with some sort of form of higher knowledge and understanding. And interestingly enough, for me, one thing that really jumped out at me is that he talked about consciousness. And I had read about consciousness from other psychologists and philosophers and never really fathomed anything about it. I just could not relate to what people said at all. I thought some things that, like I remember reading Husserl, a phenomenologist, and thinking this is absolutely brilliantly consistent and logical, but makes no sense whatsoever to me, you know. And oddly enough, through your beginnings of your doctoral dissertation, which was sort of presented to me in little pieces because you kept coming to Ottawa to visit and I would read, you know, your updated versions and sort of read your thesis over and over again, it was presented to me in a way through that I could relate to because you were talking about it in terms of modern psychological theory and trying to explain it in part in those terms. And I think that made that much more digestible for me. I was reading these other books at the same time. But what was really interesting is that we were both going to be therapists and we both were kind of struck by if this is true about the nature of consciousness, and this certainly is a much different model of everything, then everybody needs a therapist because we're all asleep and we all need to, you know, we all need to be awakened and we need help. And I found this very interesting thing recently in this book, Uncommon Wisdom, which is a book by Fritjof Capra where he's conversations with various people. It was put out, I think, in the 80s. And he has a very interesting discussion with Artie Lang about a variety of things. But what really jumped out at me was that Lang explains where the word therapist comes from. Its origins is in the Greek therapeutes was that of an attendant. Lang asserted that a therapist should be, quote, a specialist in attentiveness and awareness, unquote. And I realized when I was introduced to the fourth way, that's what I realized is that yes, the therapist should be a specialist in attentiveness and awareness. And reading people's explanations of their psychological theories and listening to therapeutic tapes, which I did a lot with you when we were compiling the data for your thesis, I realized like I don't think any of these people are really specialists in attentiveness and awareness. And so that kind of it changed my whole understanding that really, yeah, psychological theories and study is important, but you really have to change yourself. You have to wake up yourself to be a real therapist, like to really fulfill that function. You would have to be a specialist in attentiveness and awareness. And in Fritz Peter's
That's nicely expressed. Yeah.
In Fritz Peter's book, Boyhood with Gurdjieff, this is one of my favorite things, all the enigmatic things about Gurdjieff. This is from a boy who, as a 12 and 13-year-old, was Gurdjieff's attendant and cleaned up his rooms and had a very special relationship with him wrote a wonderful book called Boyhood with Gurdjieff, which gives a really, really dramatic and insightful portrait of Gurdjieff and his institute. But here's what Peter said about Gurdjieff. And Gurdjieff had an unbelievable, unless you've seen it, awareness of other people. He seemed to know so much about the human processes, about the underlying logic in man, that he was conscious of everything that took place within any human being he happened to observe. It is the same kind of faculty that an occasionally highly trained psychiatrist seems to have to a limited degree. Gurdjieff had it to an enormous degree. And, you know, that's what I think is missing in the appreciation of esoteric teachers among conventional thinkers. Nobody wants to admit or entertain the possibility that there really are people who have developed their consciousness and being, and who are exemplars of higher consciousness and being. Like, nobody really wants to recognize that. But if we do recognize that, if you're willing to entertain that idea, then everything about our knowledge about consciousness and being changes dramatically.
Gurdjieff is, I've heard people say, like, he's a man number five or man number six. I mean, he himself talks of, like, seven levels of development of people. And, it's that awareness of other people. It's that awareness of other people that you find in Beelzebub's tales, because it's like Beelzebub's observations of the life of humankind. It's like Gurdjieff always, like, just picked the essence of it, and he kind of characterizes human beings, what they're like.
Precisely.
It's precisely that kind of observation that what you're saying Fritz Peters was saying, or Capra, that's exactly kind of what Beelzebub's Tales is about. Like,
they cut through all the superficial nonsense and all the cover stories and the wow and the flutter and the noise that's on the surface, and it gets to the essence of things. And that's where he says mm-hmm. he wants to do away with all the rubbish accumulated in human mentation, and miraculously that's what he does in that book. But he does it in a way, like the way he does it through the telling of the story, is he does it on an emotional level that's quite unlike
Jim.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Here, I got a couple examples of his language in Beelzebub's Tales, a bit of how unique it is. Beelzebub was observing the Earth from the planet Mars, and he noticed something which led to his sixth visit to the planet Earth. And he recounts, "I saw this time that without moving from their place, they did with a certain thing something which resulted in a tiny puff of smoke, whereupon a being from the opposite side immediately fell down, either totally destroyed or with one or another part of his planetary body mutilated or destroyed forever. Such a means of reciprocal destruction I had never seen before." Okay, now here it's like, okay, so what it is someone here, kind of over here, did a certain something which resulted in a tiny puff of smoke, and then the man over there falls down dead or totally mutilated. And so this is his kind of like a higher dimensional view of kind of like the grotesqueness or absurdity of it. And then here's another.
How peculiar it is, too, right?
Like, yeah, how peculiar.
When you hear that, you say, wow, that's really strange.
Yeah, when you think of it in that context, how strange it is.
Like, a little puff of smoke appears over here, and then a guy falls down either dead or mutilated over there. It's like, very funny.
Okay, so here, then he goes on. "The beings of that contemporary community have been the benefactors of the other contemporary beings of your planet, offering them, as they say, their philanthropic aid, especially as regards their first being duty, namely the duty of carrying out from time to time the process of reciprocal destruction. Thanks to them, the discharge of that being duty of theirs has gradually become, for your contemporary favorites, the, quote, merest trifle. In the absence of those inventions, it used to be exceedingly arduous for those poor favorites of yours to fulfill that being duty, because they were formerly forced to spend a great deal of sweat for it. But thanks to the adaptions of every kind invented by those contemporary beings it is now, as again our esteemed Mullah Nasra Adeen says, just roses, roses. The contemporary beings now scarcely need to make any effort whatsoever in order to destroy completely the existence of beings like themselves. Sometimes, sitting quietly in what they call their smoking rooms, they can destroy, just as a pastime, as it were, 10 and sometimes even hundreds of others like themselves. Boy, it's like a parody, except like we're in a hell world now where this is being done. You know, they've got flying drones out of
Texas
in Pakistan, you know, and you kind of, someone's got a joystick there, you know.
Yeah.
It's insane. Like, it's so absolutely insane. But it shows you the kind of peculiarity, but like what a kind of an angle on, like, the warfare, eh? Like, how, yeah, at least before they had to go out and sweat and grunt, you know, now some guy sits in the smoking room and does it with a joystick, like,
yeah,
you know, and that's civilization. You know, that's progress, you know?
That's civilization and progress. that's what it is.
That's kind of what Beelzebub does. He kind of like gives you this kind of whole other perspective on what's being done. That's kind of like so different that it's like a shock. Like these are shocking in a way when you think of it in that way, you know. Someone over here does a little something with something, a puff of smoke, and someone over there falls down dead, you know.
It's like he deconstructs everything, and as you say, what he really does, though, is he penetrates the essence of things and really deals with the essence of the human psyche and like how it's all so completely deformed and wrong, and he creates this distance throughout the book from human beings, which is quite remarkable how he does that, like this feeling like, wow. You know, if you were reading this as a science fiction novel, like, you know, this imaginary world called Earth where, you know, people invent something where a puff of smoke happens over here and a guy falls dead or mutilated over there, you think, wow, what a strange, strange world, you know? And that's basically what he creates in the reader. It's like, whoa, what a strange, strange group of people. And then, you know, like Hasin is his grandson who he's telling these tales to about the three-brained beings of the planet Earth, as he refers to human beings. And they're Hasin's favorites, you know, like, and that kind of, he's mocking, like, the human narcissism and human self-satisfaction with that. Oh, you know, we're Hasin's favorites, you know?
Like, yeah.
Sort of like, you know, like a kid with an ant farm or something, you know? It's very difficult to even, yeah, it's cumulative throughout the book, too. It's that he keeps repeating these things, and it's a joke, but in a way you realize, like, this is how we are, you know? We're so self-satisfied and so proud of ourselves, and so full of ourselves that we, you know, we've evolved and human progress is so fantastic, you know? But his question is, well, what's the essence of it? What is it? What have human beings progressed and what has civilization delivered? And as he says, really the tragedy is that we've lost our capacity to respond to the appeal of faith, hope, and love, the three great paths of religious teachings past, he says, those appeals no longer work with human beings. Like, we're kind of, we're so depraved and have fallen so far that we're almost immune to any kind of intervention by sacred beings from above, even though throughout human history, he says, these sacred beings have come to try to tend to and minister to human beings and to transform their psyches, but we've every time we've taken a step forward, we've sort of fallen back, and that's the tragedy that's befallen humanity.
Yeah, they're called three main sacred being impulses: faith, hope, and love. They were the traditional sacred being impulses. And then he kind of he paradises each, like what a person today calls love or what a person today calls faith. And today, kind of faith was kind of like to believe in any old thing, and whatever you're told, you have faith in it, and we think that's faith, kind of, and yeah. How all those sacred being impulses have been distorted in the human psyche, so we have faith in any old thing and believe only lies, you know.
Susceptible to suggestibility willing. Gurdjieff has a phrase that he liked to use: willing to believe any old tale.
Yeah, which is funny, eh? Because it's Beelzebub's tales.
Yeah, exactly.
I like that. Go ahead.
No, I was just going to say it's as I say, you can read this book and certainly get a lot out of it just by reading this book in and of itself, but. What I find so interesting is that it's so completely at odds with the presentation in his oral presentations that appear in Search of the Miraculous and Views from the Real World, which were the talks he gave in Russia, in pre-revolutionary Russia, and then in the early 20s in England and the United States. And Uspensky said at one point that Gurdjieff was the finest lecture he'd ever heard, and he wasn't very impressed by Beelzebub's tales. But Beelzebub's tales is going for something completely different. It's trying to create this wave of emotion in people to bring them out of their slumber and to achieve a distance and an objectivity about the nature of their psyches and the nature of human beings. Whereas this is oversimplified, but I think in Search of the Miraculous, the presentation in that book is more directed to the intellect and is trying to reason with people and trying to appeal on that basis. And that's what's so I find so interesting. It's interesting in your book, in Psychological Illusions, is that if you have the more comprehensive picture of the way Gurdjieff taught, because he taught in very different ways at very different periods in his life, then you get a much more complete, I think, understanding of his teaching and the complexity of it, and also the brilliance of it, because the different parts reinforce and create a greater sense of the whole.
Yeah, it's certainly one of the masterpieces of literature of the past century. I can't think of anything. Well, I mean, I if I thought of it, I'm not sure what is a comparable kind of work. You know, in the past century, say, right? Can you think of anything comparable to? There are books.
I don't think it's of a different nature. I think it's quite unique in that sense because, as I say, in a way, it's because of its peculiar style. It's comparable to Joyce in the sense that somebody who's trying to deconstruct language, but mm-hmm. It's the content which really sets it apart from everything else because it's a sacred book in a very peculiar sense. Like it reads like a mythological or a speculative science fiction type of book, but because it's dealing with such enormous themes and with such important spiritual themes, it's a sacred book. But it's a sacred book that's not couched in sacred language per se. That's the thing. It's couched in the perspective of a higher, more objective intelligence, an alien intelligence who has reached the level of objective reason. All the parameters in which the tales unfold, in which they're presented, are really quite at odds with everything in contemporary thought and really quite distinct. And so, in a way, I don't think there's any book like it. I think it's quite unique. In sacred literature, like, I think it's quite unique.
Yeah, it is. Just, it's fictional, or so-called fictional in nature, and... Yeah, it's really quite rare. I'm very excited. We will do a series on Beelzebub's tales. We've gotten off on that quite a bit today, and I didn't intend to do that more because I'm hoping I'll get a proof copy to you within about 3 weeks, probably not for the next show, but the one after, and maybe we can plan out a series on Beelzebub's tales. I think it'd be really good to do. and all these new insights I had into the causes of war and the Hasnamas individuals and what he calls a Hasnamasian science and such, I think would be really valuable. So we'll do that. But at the moment, just coming back, saying about psychological illusions, incorporates both out of those aspects of the Gurdjieff teaching and is excellent for that. And I'm really looking forward to seeing the slugs in matching volume. That was interesting to speak with Zeljka today.
Had you ever talked to her before?
No. No, I hadn't. That was cool that worked out.
Yeah.
There were two things. One thing we had today was we had Donna Brown's review that she had done on the Heart Doctrine. Maybe we should leave that actually for another day. We got about half hour left. So why don't we get back and stay with the idea of the early period of us studying the Gurdjieff teaching and psychological illusions. I used that in my teaching at the university. I produced the first copy, Man's Psychological Illusions. And I also used that for 8 years in the prisons with men. I used it in my work with groups of men in a correctional center. And the idea, in the most of modern corrections is based on the idea of cognitive behavioral modification, where they conceive of human beings as having a mind capable of cognition and a body. So they see human beings as dualistic, cognitive behavioral. And so the idea of prisoner rehabilitation is to kind of change people's thinking so that it affects their behavior. It's a very sophisticated concept of it. But anyway, from a Gurdjieffian perspective, right away, that's quite absurd because human beings function mentally, emotionally, and physically. And most offenders, their primary problems, I would say, are not mental problems, but they're emotional problems of varied forms. And the emotions control the mind, so they become mental problems, but the primary focus of people's problems is the emotional center. Hey, Jim, and that really, I would say, is the practical aspect of the fourth way psychology focuses on the psychopathology of human beings' emotional centers with all their negative emotions and forms of self-love and vanity. That's one of the central concepts in the fourth way teaching about how to work on yourself and how to understand yourself and other people is trying to understand negative emotions.
And then the whole identification around a false consciousness center and identification with various groups and roles that are pathological. I think that's another part of it too. But as you say, I mean, negative emotions alone, just to deal with that is just such a major thing with everybody, but especially with people who are incarcerated or even the kids that I worked with in group homes, because just so transparent with them that most of their problems were emotional.
Yeah. It's funny when you studied, some of the first things I learned from Gurdjieff that were so valuable. One is he says human beings function mainly in three ways: mentally, emotionally, and physically. And I looked in comparison with modern psychology, they only had the mental and the physical, but they had no psychology of the emotions. They didn't regard it as a third, independent, yet significant sphere of human beings' existence. All the societies for mental disorders, they talk about people's mental health. Like the mental health organization. See, in my view, that's a misnomer. It's the basic misunderstanding. They think they're mental problems. They're not simply mental problems, although that's part of it, of course, But that was one of the first things in the Gurdjieff teaching, his idea that we're threefold instead of dual. That is like that's something that simple. And his other thing, that consciousness is separate from psychological functions of thinking, feeling, and sensing from the different bodies, like thinking and feeling and sensing, head, heart, and hands. But consciousness is something different. Consciousness is like light. And that's profoundly important. The idea of consciousness is like light, and it illuminates us inwardly so that we can be aware of thoughts, aware of feelings, aware of sensations. So consciousness is like this inner light, and we could accumulate that light. You could have more of it or you could have less of it. You could, if we become enlightened, one feels more and more illuminated. If you become more and more depressed and controlled by automaticities, you become more and more, you can live in outer darkness as you lose your way and you fall into the darkness of despair and such. So consciousness is like light, and it is separate from the psychological functions of thinking, feeling, and sensation. And I realized at that time that modern psychology had it all wrong, because William James equated consciousness with thinking, feeling, and sensations and all the rest. And that was a fundamental mistake of Western psychology that I thought I saw at that point. Jim, which was very a critical insight into like what it, the issue of what is consciousness, which is this fundamental mystery in science still today.
Yeah, and I think, you know, it's kind of a real revelation to realize that once you're challenged to try to look at things in a from a different perspective, is the idea that modern psychology just subscribes kind of unthinkingly to this idea of the duality of consciousness is really just two states, like either you're asleep or you're awake, and that there's nothing else. There's no other discrimination or distinction to be made. And as you say, the idea that generally that consciousness is equated with the psychic functions, but it's a combination of this idea that first consciousness isn't the psychic functions, and then, like within Gurdjieff's teaching, that we have an intellectual, emotional, and a moving, instinctual, sexual, like physical centers, to collapse it into three centers of intelligence. And each of these centers operates independently of the others, and that has its own speed of operation and its own way of knowing and its own memory. And that these centers interact all the time, and that they depend on one another, and so and are intimately related to one another, so that you have certain thoughts and then you start feeling certain things, or you start having certain physical sensations, or you have certain physical sensations and that creates a wave or a current of emotion, and that leads to certain thoughts. And so that these centers are intimately related to one another, but they are distinct, and that consciousness is something quite separate from each of these, so that each of the centers can operate with varying degrees of consciousness. And so throughout our day, like it's not that we're in one fixed conscious state, like that our normal waking consciousness just consists of this one state, but that we have all these variations of when at points where we're more conscious and less conscious, and we're more conscious at times in our intellectual center, and then we're more conscious sometimes in our emotional center or our physical center, but we're not conscious in all three centers at the same time. It's very difficult to do that. And that, so there's this whole matrix of possibilities between the three centers and the level and the duration of consciousness and the intensity of consciousness. So it creates for a much more complex and dynamic understanding of what the waking experience is. And I think that's something that's completely missing in modern psychology, and that people don't even begin to suspect. But when you begin to study it in yourself, which is the other aspect of the fourth way, is that this can't be studied primarily in other people or in laboratory animals or some sort of other. It has to be studied within yourself, and you have to know this in yourself. Then you see that in yourself. You see that most of the time you're not conscious, that you really are an automaton, that you think and you feel and you act and you have sensations, and it's all very automatically, happens very automatically, just like you're a machine. And then you have moments when you sort of come to, or you're woken up, and you are a little bit more conscious emotionally, or you are a little bit more conscious in terms of your intellectual functioning. But those moments are really quite rare and are separated by these long periods in which there's really just this automatic functioning of the machine within yourself, and that we really are mechanical beings, to, in Gurdjieff's terms, to whom things happen, and everything
yeah.
happens.
Yeah, so it's
an amazingly different perspective.
The associative turning of the mind that goes on in all the people all
yeah.
the time, like that's one of the main things. For Gurdjieff, is this associative thinking is and all external stimuli are always prompting different associative thoughts that send people off into their patterns of conditioned associative thinking. Sorry, I lost my train of thought a little bit.
No, but that's, and he says, you know, that people are automatons, and that the worst thing that can happen is somebody who's become a machine, but, and that really the whole thrust of modern culture and development, and Gurdjieff was pre-television and pre-computers and pre-everything that's happened in the last 60 years, you know, boy,
mm-hmm.
he'd really be appalled, I think, if he was alive today, but that this, all these influences, you know, condition people, and people are prompted by these things, and he says, you know, that we live in this state of semi-hypnotic associative, our psyches function in a semi-hypnotic associative fashion, and you know, once you begin to observe that, you can see that in yourself. If you study yourself, you can see that you are hypnotized, and that your mind is turned by all these influences and your emotions and your physical states, and how unconscious you are of so much of what you do. And this is such an amazing, this changes everything once you begin to realize this in yourself,
yeah.
and you can see it in other people. Like there's that
you
dream.
Begin. Sorry, just
yeah.
what one does is you begin the process of self-observation. So you begin observing and labeling your own negative emotional states.
Yeah.
So you begin, oh, that was negative emotions, and oh, that's imagination, which is something one struggles with in the Gurdjieff teaching. To try to struggle against imagination and associative thinking that goes with it. So you start observing these things in yourself, and the process of beginning to observe them kind of effects an inner separation, what Gurdjieff would call like of detachment or non-identification. When you begin to observe something in yourself, it effects the first level of separation from it. So there's a separation of the I from the it, or the I from the me. So one can become aware of your own pattern of thinking, even though when you're thinking those thoughts, you're usually just wrapped up in thinking those thoughts, and you're identified with them. You're not aware of what thoughts you're thinking. You're just thinking those thoughts. So when you all of a sudden you kind of step back and you start the process of self-observation, and you start trying to classify, or you try to be aware of, oh yeah, what emotions are and how those feel and where you feel them and how that's different from the thoughts, and yet how the emotions can control the thoughts, or the stomach or the sexual organs can control the mind. Different things can control the mind. So you begin this whole process of kind of systematic self-study and self-observation. And that was like a critical element in our early studies of the fourth way.
Yeah, and with that, too, is the idea of self-remembering, which is the idea of just trying to be present in such a way that you can remember, I am here, and to try to have a part of yourself that is separate and just witnessing things. And that exercise to try to do that, the first thing that it reveals is how hard it is to even remember to do that. And then secondly,
yeah.
that when you are able to do it, it changes everything. You have a very different quality of your experience. But the odd thing is that it disappears so quickly, and then you fall back asleep, and you go along, and you're and you're in your state of sleep, and then suddenly you are aware sort of dimly that, oh, I was supposed to remember myself, and then you realize, oh, I've lost consciousness, and that it's very difficult to remember yourself. And so you work to try to do that, and you begin to develop a different sense of what it is, what the I experience can consist of. Like, most of the time we exist in a state of identification with whatever has captured our interest, either internally or externally. But if you make the effort to try to separate from yourself and to witness yourself and to experience yourself objectively, then you have a very different sense of your I. You realize that this can be done, which in and of itself is a great discovery, because most people aren't aware of that and aren't aware of that. They think that they are aware of themselves normally, but then you realize it when you really start to try to do this, that no, you're not aware of yourself normally. Gurdjieff has a wonderful analogy when he says that, you know, he talks about consciousness as being light, and he says there's certain processes that happen in nature that can only happen with a lack of illumination, and that if you illuminate that, put a light on something, it changes these processes in and of itself. And that's kind of like our inner alchemy is like that, that consciousness is light. And so even if you become a little bit more conscious for even brief periods of time and make an effort to try to repeat that, it starts to change certain processes in yourself. Certain things dissipate, and other things, the nature and the quality of them change, and your experiences of yourself change, and you realize that, oh, you know, this isn't fixed, that you can actually change.
Yeah, you could actually, like, for instance, not have a negative emotion that one is having. But yeah. In a way, you can actually release it and let it go. Like, that's a main idea in the fourth way teaching, is that people normally in life, we waste all our emotional energy on things that have no objective value, especially negative emotions like anxiety, depression, hatred, anger, all different kinds of negative emotional states. So we try to become aware of those, and in a way, by observing them, it begins to introduce light into the process underlying those negative emotions. You become aware of what they are more, what they are in yourself, and how they're evoked mechanically by things around you. And as you, through that process, you become able, it's easier initially with smaller negative emotions, but then over time you get better with bigger negative emotions, and it's like, I remember feeling more and more freed of different negative emotions, that I could kind of maintain my inner sense of being and not be kind of buffeted about by everything that happens around me and within me and so on. That in a way you come to, yeah, you're not so much a cork in the ocean being bobbed this way and that by everything that happens around you, which is how Gurdjieff portrays people. It's like he says that we don't attain real I. Instead, everything that we do is like automatically controlled and conditioned by the external factors and by our history. It's a pretty dismal view he offers. And with regards to self-remembering, I remember Gurdjieff, he says, self-remembering is like a process where you study, quote, the appearance and disappearance of consciousness. I think that brings us back kind of to the essence of some of what you were just saying, eh, Jim, about,
yeah.
Like, that's, it's such a valuable process because you start becoming more aware of how much you do in a state of lacking awareness.
Yeah.
And so it kind of gave a magic to life almost, because I would try to kind of, how many times I could kind of self-remember during the day, and sometimes you'd forget for months, for years even,
yeah,
to self-remember. But then other times one could be actively self-remembering, and the more actively one did it, it brought very quick results in terms of kind of altering the quality of situations and your experiences of things. It's a very direct kind of process. It's a discovery process, self-remembering. It's like kind of view yourself almost from outside of yourself, just like Beelzebub. You're kind of looking down on the beings on planet Earth. Yeah, and that's what we do in self-remembering. We kind of look at our negative emotions and why we're pissed off because someone dented our car or whatever it is.
I like that you use the word magic because I certainly think that for us in the first few years that we began to work on this and to try to do it and to share our experiences of doing it and our observations of what happened is that it's a very magical quality to it. And there's a quote from Uspensky to the effect that real psychology begins when a man begins to try to remember himself and realizes that he can't do it, but with practice that he might be able to do it eventually or something to that effect. And I think that with respect to modern psychology, I think that this is like it's such an essential and important difference. It's like self-remembering to me is like the greatest psychological experiment that anybody has ever done or ever will do, is that try to remember yourself, and what you'll find out is, first of all, it's hard to remember yourself. Secondly, it's hard to remember yourself. Thirdly, once you do remember yourself, it's hard to sustain it. And fourthly, when you realize that you can't do it, you also realize that if you continue to try to do it, you could probably get better at it, and it would dramatically alter your consciousness and transform your consciousness. So in a sense, it really is... It's such an important method, and at the same time, it's a great psychological experiment. There was a great social psychologist, Kurt Lewin, who used to say that the best way to study anything is to introduce a change into it, and that's exactly that's the premise of self-remembering in the fourth way. The way to study consciousness is to introduce a change into it by trying to remember yourself, and everything changes with that. Like it just completely overturns all of your understanding and your previous assumptions about who you are and what you are and what you're capable of being and what properties you possess psychologically and just everything about yourself and the world. There's a great description in Search of the Miraculous when Uspensky says that after he'd been introduced to Gurdjieff's teaching and he'd been working in this group with him and learned about, Gurdjieff's contention that everybody was asleep and that we live in a sleeping world. And, Uspensky says he's walking down the Letny in St. Petersburg one day and a man is approaching him and he realized that he was completely asleep, and he said it was just so obvious to him that it was like clouds were passing over the man's face and that he was just completely unaware of everything that was going on around him. And then he said all they could see was sleeping people, and he had sort of this moment of objective consciousness in the sense of that he realized he saw that everybody around him was asleep. And I've had experiences, maybe not quite that dramatic, but certainly situations where I've seen other people where I just realized, well, they're completely asleep, that there's no doubt about it, Unfortunately, yeah. I can't say that about myself enough, but I mean, I do have moments too when I realize that I've done something retrospectively and I realize completely, utterly asleep. I mean, almost anybody who's listening to this probably has had a moment when they've driving a car, walking somewhere, where they realize that they were on automatic pilot and that they have absolutely no memory of what they've just done. Like they just sort of went from point A to point B. But that's the most dramatic example of really what our normal waking consciousness consists of. It's that automatic, automatized state where our sense of eye is so weak. It's like if, again, to use the analogy of consciousness and light, we work in darkness. We work in the dimmest light possible, and the objective is to increase the illumination so that we can begin to recognize what's actually going on in ourselves.
Yeah, and
outside.
It's an amazing process, self-remembering, and it so changes over years as you understand it differently, and partly because I would say, see, part of it is that over time, like Gurdjieff says, there are three phases to awakening, or no, to changing. He says first we have to awaken to die and to be reborn. So awakening is like when you start to observe yourself and become more conscious of yourself. And after a while, that begins, you start be awakening. You start seeing all these things in yourself. You weren't quite what you thought you were, and you see all these aspects. So it's kind of awakening and then dying in a way, because as you kind of awaken to it, certain aspects of yourself you die to. In a way, you let them go, or they are no longer you. So what your sense of yourself might have been tied up in is no longer what you take to be yourself. In a way, there's a breakdown of false ego. So you're kind of dying. This false consciousness system, in a way, is being deconstructed. You know, you've been conditioned in a way, mentally, emotionally, and physically, and you become this kind of automaton under all this conditioning. And then you start becoming conscious. And the more you become, when you become conscious of things, it breaks down the automaticity of your patterns of thinking and feeling and reactions. So you start breaking down this conditioning, and it gives that inner feeling, what I experience of inner freedom and of the release of energies that would otherwise have been tied up in whatever that those negative emotions or that associative thinking or whatever. So it's liberating. It's kind of observing yourself and kind of liberating these energies kind of tied up in different emotions and activity. And then maintaining those in states of wakefulness. And as you do that, it allows you over time, I find, to be more and more conscious of things around you in a broader and different way than one used to be. Not that you would ordinarily necessarily do that, but you're capable of doing it. See, Gurdjieff sees people as having no inner motor. You have no eye. See, only a person, the psychological illusions. The main psychological illusion, I would say, is that people think you know yourself. See, Gurdjieff, from my perspective, people do not ordinarily know themselves. They only know their persona or ego and not their true self. And the mystics want to know yourself. Well, the self you want to know is that which is hidden. So in a way, we have to kind of deconstruct the false consciousness system to get back to our essence, because our real I is like the core of our essence. So we have to break down this kind of acquired second nature. And then as we do that, then we're kind of reborn again in our essence. So that's part of like the deconstruction process that goes on within a person who kind of works on themselves with the fourth way teaching. Jim, I noticed we've got just over five minutes or so left. I'll just let, where would you like to pick up?
I think that's a very good description of the objective. And again, it's like what I was saying earlier about the therapist, is that you have to become, in a sense, you have to become your own therapist in Lang's terms, becoming an expert in attention and an awareness about yourself. And as you say, the primarily psychological illusion is that people think they know themselves, but what we know is more the false consciousness system and the persona that's been imposed and that we've acquired through our conditioning and our socialization, our education, and all sorts of dubious sources of wisdom outside and ourselves and even within ourselves. And the idea is to break that down and to let it go. And as you said, that self-remembering is such a dynamic concept that it changes over time, but that it does allow one a sense of freedom, because you begin to separate from so much of what, you know, has become your acquired self and is not real. And you begin to see the false consciousness system in yourself. You begin to see the falsity of it all, and you begin to realize that in order to be and to become more conscious, you need to you need to let go of so much. And a big part, I think, too, is that you have to unlearn so much. You have to just drop so much of what you think you know about yourself and the world, and it, you know, you have to become foolish to become wise. So you have to
drop
a lot.
And that's a magical process. I remember it being such a feeling of discovery and a newness to life. I remember when I used to teach at York University, I used to use this material in class. And I think in our next show, Jim, you know, in this book, it has this whole section of like the fourth way definitions of psychology. Yeah. And that used to be the prime. Everyone who took any course with me had to learn that, eh? Because it kind of captures the essence of what the fourth way psychology is. I'd really like to try to go through those definitions of psychology, eh? I used to, everybody on their exams, there were 8 of them. They had to memorize them. They even knew ahead of time what the question was. It wasn't, I just wanted them to learn it, you know, just remember it. And then
there's a whole new scheme to understanding all and everything. And we should go through that because it's, you know, it's very interesting, and taken together, it's a very interesting set of axioms that you know provides an entirely different perspective on things.
Yeah, and explore a little bit some of the like the illusions of consciousness, like what we used to call nature's little trick, and that's all very interesting. So next week we'll pick up again and try to go through some of the material of psychological illusions, and then after that we'll go and start some shows on the Beelzebubs.
Yeah, that's good because I need a little bit of time because I want to reread Beelzebub's Tales. So you know, it'd be nice to have a little bit of time to do that. I'm looking forward to reading it again because, as you say, you know, it's so there's so much to it, and each time you get you get something different from it. But I think I'd be very curious to see how I understand it now because I haven't read it for many, many years. So looking forward to it.
Yeah, great.
Yeah, good.
Okay, well, thanks for being here again today, and it's an exciting time for me to be seeing my books getting published. I would like to encourage people, these 3 books of mine, The Heart Doctrine, God, Science, and The Secret Doctrine, and Psychological Illusions, are all very valuable. They're available through Amazon Books. And I've done recent revisions to my website. I have a critique of Stephen Hawking's new book up there called The Grand Design. And I hope to be putting some new writings from the slugs up there within the next week.
Yeah, and if people want to go online and access the Esoteric Quarterly, you have an article and a review, an article in their first part, and also the review of The Heart Doctrine as it appears in the current issue. And you just go online to the Esoteric Quarterly, and it's there.
You can actually also access Donna Brown's new review of The Heart Doctrine from my site, too. I've put it up there as well. Make it accessible. Yeah, an excellent review. The more I read it, I grasped it and got it more and more, and what a good review it was.
It's a very, very perceptive and review. She really gets it.
She does. She's really scholarly.
She really puts it in perspective with regard to their current ideas and consciousness research. So she understands how important the book is.
Great.
Thanks to Seth at BBS and to Don and Doug and to everybody. Thanks a lot.
And we'll be back in 2 weeks' time. Thank you all.
Yeah.
Goodbye.
Great. See you.